On this week's 51%, we kick off Women's History Month and speak with science journalist Heather Pringle about her book, The North Women, taking a look at the larger roles women played in Viking society.
We can't make these sweeping assumptions about the past, that women were always, you know, homemakers and mothers. They're very important roles, but that's not all that the women were doing.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The month of March is Women's History Month, and so much of what we talk about on this show can get heavy, so, you know, I wanted to start off Women's History Month by talking about something fun. We're going to go way back, before even American history, to the time when Vikings were conquering, pillaging, and trading throughout Europe and sailing their way toward North America. When most of us think about Vikings, or see depictions of them on TV, I'm a Marvel fan, I've seen the Thor movies, but we think of its men, powerful warriors and sailors. But archaeologists today are finding more and more that women played key roles in Viking society, and even on the battlefield. Our guest today is Canadian science writer Heather Pringle, who has shaped her career around writing about archaeology. Her latest book is The North Women, Untold Stories from the Other Half of the Viking World. Pringle says she was inspired to write it after visiting the Museum of the Viking Age, also known as the Viking Ship Museum, in Oslo, Norway. She says one of the most elaborate ships on display at the museum was believed to have served as an ornate coffin for, presumably, two very prominent Vikings. But those Vikings were not men, but two women. Pringle says that trip got her thinking about how we think about Vikings and Viking women.
For a very long time, Viking specialists had a specific image of Viking women. They thought that Viking women were largely homemakers and wives, that the women were basically operating within the private sphere. So women didn't take part in public life. They were, you know, busy in the home, you know, taking care of young children, you know, basically cooking, preparing food, and also weaving cloth, which was very important in terms of clothing families. So women were seen in a very kind of restricted light, it seems to me. And that was based on sort of these sweeping assumptions that Viking specialists made. They felt that these were gender roles that were universal and timeless, and the Viking women fit into this mold of only operating within the private sphere. Now, they saw men very differently. They saw men as being individuals who were in the public sphere. They were the ones who were, you know, fighting the wars, going off on raiding parties. They were the ones who were ruling politically, feasting in the great halls. And it was all kind of, you know, this was a man's world. And women didn't really have much of any role in that power politics of the time, or in the, you know, the military campaigns and battles. So it was a very black and white picture of the Viking world. And this was the picture for a very long time, as I say. And it was only fairly recently, I would say within the last 30 or 40 years, that some Viking specialists, particularly some archaeologists, said, wait a minute, guys, what we're starting to see in our excavations is showing us that women played a range of roles. They were starting to come up with evidence that women were, you know, for example, they were magic workers, they were seeresses, they were sorceresses, they were queens, they were even traders, they were warriors, and so on. There was quite a range of roles. Now, archaeologists that came forward with these ideas often suffered a lot of criticism initially, and even today, I would say, the criticism continues, because there are some diehard archaeologists who really don't think it's possible that women, for example, could have fought on a battlefield in hand-to-hand combat. However, There's been some really interesting research coming out of Sweden on a particular burial in a place called Birka. And this burial shows us a very different kind of woman warrior. And if you like, I could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'd love to learn more.
Okay, well, so in Birka, I should say, is one of these very early towns. It's on a little island just not that far from Stockholm. There was a military garrison there. And there was also, as archaeologists discovered when they started excavating in Birka, there were several large cemeteries there. But there was one cemetery that was quite an elite cemetery that was very close to the military garrison. It was sort of, right up practically against the gate of the military garrison. And during excavations in 1877, a very astute archaeologist, Swedish archaeologist by the name of Hjalmar Stolpe, excavated a grave of a warrior. And the grave was filled with weaponry, Viking weaponry, swords, shields, two shields, I think it was. The list is really impressive. I think it's two spears, a lot of armor-piercing arrows, and then two horses, and probably a saddle. And the individual was buried in this sort of underground chamber with all these weapons. And it was a really impressive grave. So Stolpe, when he excavated it, he said, "This is a warrior grave. This is a male warrior grave." And his interpretation, and I just want to make one point here, just very quickly, is that archaeology is a science in which people interpret the data. And so there are always interpretations of finds. And not everyone agrees with a particular interpretation. Not all archaeologists will necessarily agree with a particular interpretation. There'll be, conflicting ideas. But in this case, with Stolpe and the warrior grave, a grave that people now call BJ 581, this grave, there was very little disagreement. People agreed, yes, this is a male warrior grave, very high-ranking male buried in this grave. He's buried right next to the military garrison. That position in the cemetery would not have been available to just anybody. It was available to someone who was an important warrior and very high ranking. So this was the interpretation right up until 2016 or 17. 2017, a team of Swedish researchers published the results of a DNA study that they had conducted on the skeletal remains of the warrior in this very famous grave. And lo and behold, this individual was a biological female. This was a female. This created a lot of controversy. It became a very, how to say it, was a very popular paper in terms of readership. It was an incredibly well-read paper that was published in Antiquity, which is a very important archaeological journal. What is interesting, that controversy has started to settle down. There are still some archaeologists that feel like there was some error at some point in the analysis of that grave. Many archaeologists have told me that they found it, the article, the DNA work, and so on, very convincing. There was actually a follow-up article published in 2019, and they presented a very convincing argument for the presence of a female, a biological female in this grave. And what was interesting was when I was in Sweden talking to researchers, I interviewed several members of the team that excavated, or probably not excavated, but did the DNA study on BJ 581, this contentious grave. And one of the archaeologists is someone who has excavated in the military garrison. She has Charlotte Hedenstierna Johnson. She has done extensive work in the military garrison and excavated the kinds of weaponry that you find in the garrison and so on, and is quite an authority on the warriors of Birka. What she feels, what she thinks about this grave, based on the findings in the grave, the fact that the individual, this biological female, was buried probably seated in a saddle with two horses in the grave. And this woman was buried with a Eurasian riding jacket, very expensive, costly riding jacket that was probably made in the Ukraine somewhere, suggested to Charlotte that the woman in the grave may have been someone who fought on horseback. An Eastern style of combat might have been a mounted archer. There was something like two dozen arrows in this particular grave. So Charlotte's idea is that this woman might have been someone who fought in the cavalry, kind of. And we don't often think of Vikings as fighting on horseback, but indeed they did, particularly in places in the East. The Vikings were very active in their, they traveled in both Eastern Europe, and of course they also traveled across the North Atlantic Ocean to Iceland, Greenland, and eventually to North America. But in places like Eastern Europe, the Vikings seem to have fought on horseback. I actually interviewed a researcher who I'd known in through d work she had done on the DNA of the famous Iceman in Europe. And she is trained as she's trained as a mounted warrior. So I interviewed this researcher, Angela Grafen, and I asked her, do you think it's possible that this woman buried in Bearcut could have been a mounted warrior? And she thought, yes, it was possible. She wanted to see more research on this before she came to a, before she could reach any conclusions. But she said, the thing about women who are mounted archers is that it kind of levels the playing field. So in other words, you don't have to have these, don't have to be tremendously muscular to be a mounted warrior. You have to be a very good equestrian. You have to be very skilled and experienced as an archer. But it sort of levels the playing field in terms of warfare. And in fact, in the Olympics, both women and men compete together in equestrian events. She made this point that it's certainly possible that this woman could have been a mounted archer.
Wow, that's really cool. Were there other roles that women were playing in Viking society too?
Oh, sure. There were quite a few different kinds of roles that women were taking. One of them was as traders. Again, we can go back to Bearcut. It's very interesting. I think it was in the 1980s or so. Researchers start to look at the burials of women and burials that included trading equipment. So the Vikings had what's called a metal weight economy, which means that if you wanted to buy something, let's say you were at a market or approached a merchant and want to buy, let's say you want to buy a piece of jewelry, a ring pin, for example. Well, what you would do is you would offer the merchant a set weight of silver. Usually it was silver in the Viking world. You could offer gold, but silver was the most common, it seems. You could offer the merchant a set weight of silver. And so what the merchant would do is say, okay, well, he or she would pull out a portable scale. You would, as a potential buyer, would put your silver on one side of the scale, and the merchant would put some standard weights on the other. And when the set weight had been reached in terms of the amount of silver, then the purchase was complete. So these scales were usually very indicative of a merchant. They were standard tools of a merchant's trade. And so in Bearcut, what was interesting is that there was a female archaeologist who started taking a look at these graves to see if she could find, any female graves with the weights. And what she found was so cool. She found, I think it's 32% of the graves that there was something like 130 graves that contained either portable scales or the weights that were used with the portable scales. And what she found is, I think it was 32% belonged to women, and only 28 belong to men. Now, that doesn't add up to 100%. The other remaining percentage were graves that couldn't be identified by sex or were graves that belonged to couples. But of the graves that were single graves that could be identified by sex, there were more, slightly more female graves than there were male graves. And this is interesting because in the sagas, and these were the old stories, the sagas were part of a very ancient oral tradition in the Viking world. And then when the Viking Age ended, about 200, 100 to 200 years after the Viking Age ended, these stories were actually written down by Christian scholars. So that's how we have the sagas today. And the Christian scholars were mainly in Iceland, but not exclusively so. The thing about the sagas is that they are not 100% historical. There's a lot of mythology that's in them, and there are passages that are clearly very creative and very fictional in these sagas too. So there's always been a big debate about the sagas. I mean, how much of it is actually historical and factual, and how much of it is fictional and comes from the imagination of the storyteller. So, but coming back to the point about the trading women, there are not, to my knowledge, any stories in the sagas that show us women traders. So the fact that the sagas don't make any mention of them may not mean that they never existed, because now we have this archaeological evidence of women who are buried with the weighing equipment. So it is quite possible that women actually did play roles as traders.
I guess, as you're digging into the research and writing about this, has it changed your perception about Vikings at all? What do you hope we take away from the stories in your book? Because, I think Viking imagery and mythology and culture is still very present in our popular culture today in terms of TV and films and comic books and things like that. A lot of our storytelling still references Viking culture.
Oh, it sure does. There's no question about it. And so often what we'll see in our popular entertainment, if I was thinking about this while I was writing the book, in our popular entertainment, we'll usually see a male Viking lord or warlord, or we might see a male Viking god, Thor. And it is very skewed towards men. And what I would absolutely love to see is why don't we have popular entertainment that really focuses as a central character, picks as its central character a female military commander? Because it appears that there were female military commanders in the Viking world. There's a few historical references to them, and of course we have this wonderful grave from Berka now. So one of the big takeaway messages that I've come to when I was writing the book is that we can't, that Viking specialists, that we can't make these sweeping assumptions about the past, that women were always, homemakers and mothers and cloth makers. Those are very important roles, and I'm certainly not denigrating that. They're very important roles, but that's not all that the women were doing. I think we need to take the blinders off. And once we start taking the blinders off, we start seeing that women were actually incredibly important in all kinds of ways in this, these Viking enterprises of raiding and trading. I mean, for example, it was women weavers who are making the sails for the Viking ships. I mean, these sails are huge. Some of them are about the size of 20 king-sized beds pushed together. Archaeologists have done what they call experimental archaeology. They've replicated Viking vessels and, authentic Viking vessels. They've basically copied them using traditional technology and traditional materials. They commissioned textile experts in Scandinavia to weave sails for these ships using very traditional methods, weaving wool actually into sails, and the women were the modern day women who were doing this were very highly skilled textile workers. And one estimate for the amount of time that it would have taken to make a sail for a large Viking warship was 10,269 hours. That is Those are women's hours. I want to just stress that the women were the weavers, and this is the work of women. That's just for one sail. Often Viking fleets took two sails with them, so that would be over 20,000 hours, and that's just one ship. And sometimes these Viking fleets, they would have 120 ships or more. But we're talking about a tremendous amount of work that the women put into making sails for the Viking fleets. It's just women were essential parts of all these enterprises that we have thought of as being, oh, it's the men, the men are doing it.
I can't even wrap my head around just 10,000 hours of weaving. That's amazing. And this is just me personally talking here, but I think everything you've mentioned so far, it just reminds me that the way we view history can often be shaped by our own biases and just the assumptions that we were raised to have. That shapes our worldview, and then that ends up shaping how we look back at history too.
I completely agree with you. I think that researchers have made a lot of assumptions, and I think it's only pretty recently, within the last few decades, that really and I hate to say it, but I do think it has happened increasingly as more women enter the field of archaeology. When I first start writing about archaeology, back in the 1980s, I would go to conferences and there would be very few women in the room, and that's certainly not the case today. I mean, increasingly women are playing very important parts in the field of archaeology. And I do think that as women have entered the field, they have started asking questions. They haven't made these assumptions. I do think the increasing presence of women in the field of archaeology has, changed the field for the better.
Well, Heather, thanks for coming on. This has been fun. Do you have any other weird Viking facts or stories about Viking women that you'd like to share with us?
Oh gosh, there would be quite a few, but I mean, I'll take one Viking woman who is mentioned in historical texts, or in the sagas, but also mentioned briefly elsewhere. And this is Gudrid the Wide Traveled. So Gudrid was born in Iceland in around about 890 AD. Oh, pardon me, a little bit later, pardon me, 990. She eventually married the brother of Leif Erikson, who is the Viking chieftain who is thought to have been the first person to set foot in North America. So Gudrid married the brother of Leif Erikson. Unfortunately, she was widowed. Her husband died of of illness, and she married a merchant, Thorfinn, and she convinced Thorfinn to mount an expedition to North America. And so she and her husband and a small Viking expedition traveled to North America. It is likely that they were present at a base camp that is known today as L'Anse aux Meadows in Newfoundland. Gudrid gave birth to a son in North America, her son Snorri, that was the first European child that was born in North America. Eventually, Gudrid and her husband moved back to Iceland. And after her husband died, Gudrid was a Christian. She was one of the early converts to Christianity. She did a pilgrimage to Italy. And this is as quite an old woman. She did a pilgrimage after she was widowed, and she traveled. She seems to have reached Rome. She may have had an audience with the Pope because she would have been such an unusual pilgrim there. I mean, this woman from Iceland who had actually been to North America, she would have had some amazing stories to tell. Anyway, she returned to Iceland, and according to one research, she was probably the most well-traveled woman in the medieval world. And this is a Viking woman. I think that's an amazing story.
Heather Pringle is a science journalist specializing in archaeology and the author of The North Women, Untold Stories from the Other Half of the Viking World. It's out now through National Geographic. Heather, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me onto the program.
So Switching gears now, March 8th is International Women's Day. This year's theme is Accelerate Action for Gender Equality. At a time when diversity, equity, and inclusion and reproductive rights are under attack by the federal government, organizations like Girls Inc. of the Greater Capital Region are still working to foster a positive space for girls looking to work on their leadership skills and build confidence in whichever career they choose to pursue. WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke with CEO Ashley Fragomini and her stepdaughter Lily about how Girls Inc. is pushing girls to shape the future.
I like to say that Girls Inc. of the Greater Capital Region is a resource. So if you need us for a conversation, if you need a safe place to eat a meal, if you need a safe person to speak to, if you need to be around like-minded peers, all of those things. We pride ourselves on being a community center that has people and experiences for anyone who needs them.
You, of course, work with young girls all the time. Politicians across the nation are arguing that children don't understand gender and it's not something they need to be thinking about at such a young age. Do you ever hear them discussing gender in a politicized way or any way that makes them unsure about themselves?
You know, I think that Girls Inc. as an organization really provides space for all sorts of conversation. So I think the answer to your question is yes. We hear girls think and out loud and speak about all sorts of issues that they are experiencing internally, issues that they're watching on the news, things that they see or that they're modeling from experiences that they're maybe having at home. And our goal is always to do the right thing by providing the space for the conversation. And in fact, one of the things that we've done recently, which we're really excited about, to kind of answer the call to the questions being asked or the conversations being had, is we've retained an on-site social worker who now is, you know, licensed in that area so that she can be helping us and helping our girls dig through the questions they may have. And again, I think part of being a strong community partner and a resource is not always having the answer for the kids, but knowing who to connect them with. So that's why things like our board of directors and our Council of Women for Girls are so important, because we identify that while we may be the expert in the girl, even experts need resources, right? So this partnership and this community advocacy that we have around moving girls forward and tackling tough conversations and giving them the confidence to make decisions or the confidence to have their voice be heard is not a fight that we can fight alone.
And you brought your stepdaughter Lily here with you today. So Lily, you're, I assume, in middle school or early high school?
High school.
So when you're, you know, discussing with your classmates, you know, just the internal thoughts of a woman or a young girl, what does that look like for you guys?
We talk a lot about what we wear and what we do, like makeup wise, and what we'll do when we're older is a lot of what we talk about, and like what people want to be and where they want to go to college and how they want their life to look when they're older and grown up, and if they still want, like, still wanting to be friends with each other and all of that kind of thing.
Do you feel a positive outlook with that, or is it more like stressful conversations?
I think it can be both. It depends on how it's looking, but I think when we talk about what we're doing when we're older, it's a bit stressful based on how they talk about it in school and getting into college and all of that stuff.
So Girls Inc. offers free programming for girls, and I know there's athletic programs and STEM and summer camps. So how do these types of programs support girls and their youth to ensure that when they grow up, they're going to be confident in their ability when they step into a room or on a field or wherever it may be?
Yeah. So one thing I love about the menu of options at Girls Inc. is that we aren't focused on just one thing. So a lot of our curriculum has that STEM-based, research-based feel to it. And we really do focus on STEM because of wanting to make sure that we are having equal representation in STEM fields between men and women. But what the cool thing about the menu of options is that we're making sure girls are trying everything. So if a girl is, you know, wanting to potentially go out for the debate team, we're making sure that we're having conversations with her about what it looks like to be behind that podium and put on a debate and do the research necessary. If a girl is like, you know, I really want to try sports, but I haven't had the opportunity yet, then we're trying out a sport, right? Like, we're doing all of these things and giving them a taste of it. And then again, connecting them to our community partners who may be able to give them more of that said thing. But the idea is that when a girl gets to be the age where she has to decide, what do I want to go to college for? Where do I want to go to college? What do I want to be when I get older? She can look back at her experience as a Girls Inc. girl and say, I've had these opportunities, and now I can go ahead and make a really informed decision based on what my life was as a Girls Inc. girl. And to me, that's the best way, again, that we can show up for our girls, is like, you are going to have to make a decision someday. So let me help you. Let us help you try everything safely without risk, really, so that when you have to make a decision that maybe is a little risky, you have all of the confidence and self-esteem to be able to do it.
Obviously, social movements have moved women's issue to the forefront of agendas like abortions and maternal care, and a whole slew of other things. But what would you say should be the biggest item on the table right now? And looking to the future, what issues that have yet to be blown up do you think will become a big deal?
Wow. What a big question. I think this idea that DEI no longer matters, and I'm going to use my air quotes there, is a really scary thing to say and to put out there. I can't think of a time in my life where DEI didn't matter. Maybe that's because I'm a woman. Maybe it's because I consider myself to be highly intelligent. I'm not 100% sure. But I think it's really scary when we start taking big, real things away from people and saying that DEI doesn't matter or isn't a thing is scary, because we're dealing with girls and women and we're working to inspire them and we're working to motivate them. And then to feel like this glass ceiling that has been shattered by all of the women that came before me and you is now slowly, piece by piece, being put back intact is terrifying. I mean, I'm a CEO of a girl serving organization. I feel like I've lived a very successful professional career, and I'm not even 40 yet. And I'm scared. So I can't imagine when I look, you know, to my left and I see my bonus daughter at 14, you know, and I think like, well, what is her life going to look like in 4 years or 10 years? Like, is she going to have to fight now three times as hard to get half as far as I have or her mom has, you know? And it's scary to think that. So I think right now what's most important to us is to combat what could be if we don't get back to putting diversity, equity, inclusion, welcoming, and belonging where it should be, which is the forefront of what we do when we're serving our youth. Our youth are everything. We are, every day we wake up as adults and we're supposed to be paving the road for them, not just to be successful, but to have meaningful and impactful conversations, experiences, jobs, feel their place in the world. And what's happening right now, I think, can feel very scary to some of them, which is that they maybe don't matter as much. And that's a terrifying thing. And that's a race issue. That's a gender issue. That's an equity issue. And that's scary. So I think, you know, every day I'm going to wake up like I have since the start of my career in youth development, which is making sure that I do my part in making the world a better, safer place for our youth. And I implore everybody to do the same.
That was Ashley Fragomini, CEO of Girls Inc. of the Greater Capital Region, and her stepdaughter Lily speaking with WAMC's Samantha Simmons. Girls Inc. has sites in Albany, Troy, and Schenectady, New York, and their after-school programs serve more than 150 girls daily. You can learn more at girlsinccapitalregion.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. Nightmare down the hallway. my cool.